Hey there, I'm Pete Townsend, and this is Money Never Sleeps. We look inside the minds of entrepreneurs and at the crossover of startups, enterprise, finance, technology, and life as we know it. In this episode, I'm joined by guest co-host Paul Smith. Paul is a specialist executive recruiter and executive coach within the fintech industry, and as a founder of two startups, he's got a unique view on the startup ecosystem. Paul and I met back in 2017, shortly before I photobombed his stand at a fintech event in Dublin. We've collaborated quite a bit since then. He and his business partner and life partner, Laura Smith from Top Tier Recruitment, were the original sponsors of Money Never Sleeps back in 2018. And since then, Paul has also launched the Possible.ie executive coaching business that counts me as one of their proud customers. I was so happy with the outcome of Paul's coaching of me that I asked him to coach the founders that we bring through the Techstars Web3 Accelerator. As one of the many hats he wears, Paul is a fantastic coach in residence for Techstars, helping startup founders find their way to positive outcomes. In this Money Talk segment, Paul and I kick things off with a look at Sam Bankman-Fried's 25-year sentence before looking at the brighter side of things with BlackRock's new tokenized money market fund. We then time travel back to the year 2017, or so we thought, with Copper's sushi party, and close things out by questioning the correlation between fintech funding and the crypto bull run. All right here on Money Never Sleeps. Paul Smith, great to have you back.
Thanks, Peace. Always a pleasure.
You have a wonderful new little addition to the world, don't you?
I do. Little baby Jude is, God, I should be quicker at answering this, 4.5 weeks old or 5.5? It's been a blur.
Yeah, it usually
five
is.
Five and a half weeks. Yeah.
I used to say that they weren't weeks. They were just these like 120 plus hour time frames that are stapled together one next to the other. It's like
amazing how a day feels like 120 hours sometimes. Yeah. Especially with a nearly 3-year-old running around. To be fair, you never know how it's going to go with a second and how the first is going to react. And Alex has been great, but he's just full of energy. So he wakes up at 6 or 7 or whatever time he decides he's waking up. And he's 100% straight away. There's no warm up. There's no settling into the day. It's just complete madness.
Yep.
But apart from that, all good. Relatively well rested.
I remember those days well. And yes, there was something that I did the calculation once. I've changed over something like 2,500 nappies in my day. So there's plenty more ahead for you of that, which is a wonderful, joyful thought. Part of being a father. I have a friend who hit 3 with his youngest, and he had not yet changed a nappy for her. And you think she'd be, maybe she was 2.5, something like that. But it was quite mysterious that he's like, dude, do you know how to do this? When he had his youngest out with me and 2 of my kids. And I'm like, yeah, you want some help?
Yeah. No, I learned very quickly. So after we had Alex, which was during COVID, we went up to the post-delivery suite or whatever you call it, up to the room anyway in the rotunda. And I kind of thought that the midwife might help with the first one, but it was very much, you know, here you go, enjoy.
Yeah.
And Laura was still recovering. Oh, I had no choice. So yeah, I got inducted to nappies very early on, hasn't it?
All right.
Skill piece, it's a life skill.
It is a skill. And I've noticed on LinkedIn recently, Paul, that you've been a bit more thoughtful and maybe a bit more expressive. And that I was thinking that might have something to do with reflections upon being a father the second time now, that it was really good one that you did on being the one version of yourself, right?
Yep.
Rather than having a work self and having a personal self, right? That it's just always just be that one version of yourself. It totally resonated with me because I've always said, listen, it's always easiest when there's only one version of the truth to tell, you know?
Yeah. With that one, and I think I referenced it in that post, and I probably have a couple of times over the years, I think you'd asked me a question for the 100th episode of Money Never Sleeps. And that was the answer I came up with on the spot when I did the presentation to this current group of Techstars. And it was all about the Oscar Wilde quote, be yourself because everyone else is already taken.
Totally.
And it's that idea of being authentically you and that building kind of a strong core and a strong foundation for whatever it is that you're doing. You at work, you at home, it's still you at the end of the day. So closer you can be to that person, the more consistently you can be that person, the easier life is for you, I think. And you're able to handle the external stuff an awful lot better. But you know, I think as you journey through life, you can very easily move away from who you are at your core. And certainly one of the big things for me when I trained as a coach, being coached while I was being trained as a coach, was and getting back to who I am authentically. And a big realization was how far I'd actually moved away from the person. So, yeah, that's a nice deep way to start today.
Good to have you back. No, that's it. And it's like, I totally get that, because when you think about, you know, being yourself at the end of my day, right? I just step outside that door behind me that you can see in the background on video that all of you out there in podcast land, the listeners, can't actually see because we don't do video and will not, because it's so much work, and that it's much more fun just to express ourselves through the spoken word rather than the visual images as well. That being said, I got a buddy who gets home every day after work and he has two martinis because he needs to transform himself from his work self back to his personal self. Yeah. And he can only do that with two martinis.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, all right, hey, whatever blows your hair back. I just don't. I just walk outside that door. And it's like, you know, not even a Superman phone box or anything like that. It's just my office. So
yeah. A friend of mine used to park the car down the road and just kind of sit there in his own thoughts for about half an hour before he transitioned back into personal, whatever his name was, which obviously won't be revealed.
I know, I know. And well, I mean, in this day and age, I just don't have that kind of time on my hands. I just got to get on with it. But someone who does have time on his hands now is Sam Bankman-Fried, right? So he was sentenced last week to 25 years in prison because it's a federal judge and a federal crime that he was convicted of. He has to serve at least 85%, I think, of the term. So he will be in his mid to late 50s by the time he gets out, right? So he does have a lot of time on his hands. I've been hearing that he's been doing things such as, actually, I'm not sure if he was doing taxes for people like Andy Dufresne in Shawshank Redemption. But he was doing something of the effect to help some inmates. And, you know, with that, with this long of a stretch coming up, he's going to need to be a nice guy, or else he's going to get, you know, there might be not nice things happening to him while he's in prison. So I think a lot of the crypto space out there was like, well, you know, finally, good. We've closed the book. We've closed the door on this. He's now gone. He's out of it. Others have been like, oh, Jesus, we better be careful, you know, and we better shore up our business and organization. Others were like, 25 years, not enough. How come he didn't get 50? And I'm almost kind of thinking like, sure, you could have given him 50 or 60 or 70 or 80, but with appeals processes, with all this kind of stuff, I don't know what happened behind closed doors, but I got to think the judge here was like, listen, let's just try to give him something that's going to be obviously a big punishment, but also at the same time, let's not lengthen out this legal process anymore by Sam kind of fighting back and saying, listen, let's appeal a 50-year sentence. Let's try to get this down to something more reasonable. And I think eventually the process would have gone in that direction, I expect, one after another. So I've kind of settled myself on 25 years and I'm fine with that. And hopefully he gets some good reading done while he's in jail.
Yeah, no doubt it'll be a different world when he comes out, certainly in the space that he operated in. The big thing for me and the reaction I've seen on the recruitment side when I'm working in the digital asset space is with everything that's happened in terms of FTX, the increased regulatory scrutiny, more and more institutional interest in digital assets, I think there's a sense of FTX almost being a little bit of a watershed moment where it forced regulatory scrutiny more and more, which gave a little bit more comfort and security, ironically. But, you know, doing a country manager for a VASP in Ireland, actually two of them now at the minute, but if I was doing that role a couple of years ago, you'd get people just saying straight no. Anything they heard about crypto or anything related to digital assets, it was straight no. Now it's not. A lot more interest, a lot more comfortable in the space. So I think it's a good thing overall.
Yeah. And hopefully some of these people do get their money back, right? Or, and I think that the some of the latest news around that is that, yes, the $8 billion that was in FTX, that those assets, they draw the line at the point in time of the loss and what crypto was worth at that point, and then they convert that into USD. And so you will get that USD equivalent at that point in time. Now, I don't know what they're going to do about futures and about other types of derivative instruments that FTX were well known for and how that's all going to work out. But I mean, the case itself, and we've covered it so much on this podcast over the last couple of years, has been, you know, just a major example here of how not to run a business. Never mind in crypto, in finance, it's just how not to run a business.
Yeah, completely. It's like a the whole kind of corporate governance piece was just completely lacking.
Yeah.
Just wasn't there at all.
The one thing that was just picking away at me is, what prison is he going to end up in? You know?
And he's going to visit? Yeah, get him on the podcast.
Exactly. Why not? Need to know where he's going to be, because, you know, he's plenty of time on his hands. But they're looking at a couple of different ones. I think one of the rules is that you need to be within 500 miles of your family. And so that means somewhere roughly in or around California or West Coast for him. And that there were two that they had pointed out as perhaps being, yeah, prisons he might be sent to. So one called Atwater, one called Mendota would be his best outcome. They're minimum security prisons, probably a bit more like a hostel at the top of O'Connell Street back in the 90s than something like in Shawshank Redemption with poor Andy Dufresne. So
yeah, obviously the listeners can't see, but it actually looks like Pete's looking at TripAdvisor right now, checking out the ratings of various low security federal prisons in and around the California area.
Yes, TripAdvisor is where you find all the best information on where to pick out your favorite prison to spend a few days. So, okay. So a guy called, and this is in a post by Unchained, which is a podcast by Laura Shin. And they spoke with a guy called Christopher Zoukas for this post, who consults with criminal defendants on their sentencing. So he said, the Bureau of Prisons does take into account for very notorious cases. For more cause célèbre, they try to place people at institutions where they will be safe. High security prisons are like war zones. Inmates run everything. So he said that if I'm a betting man, I'd say he goes to FCI Terminal Island in San Pedro, referring to this low security institution next to the port of Los Angeles. It has more of a jail feel to it than the minimum security camps, but it is known as a fairly cushy place to do time, with major COVID outbreak and ongoing infrastructure issues being more notable than inmate violence. All right. So I kind of point to, do you remember Michael Milken?
No.
Michael Milken was part of the whole, look at the FTX of the 80s, really, which was a new instrument, a new innovation in finance called junk bonds. And Michael Milken ran businesses that were kind of the major purveyors of junk bonds, and that they did a lot of things wrong. And there was some insider trading. And so he was sent to jail. And there's a book called Barbarians at the Gate, written in the 80s, that I read when I was in college, that kind of told the whole story of what happened. And he probably did a few years in jail. He had cancer while he was in jail. He came out. And now he's set up a pretty decent institution called the Milken Institute. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank that helps people build meaningful lives. I know a few folks that are involved with it, really good people. When that you think about the parole board that Red had to go through coming out of Shawshank Prison, that he said something like,
that kid's long gone. This old man is all that's left. I got to live with that.
Listen. I wonder what Sam's parole board speech will be in probably about 20 years, because 20, 25, 20 years is probably be about the time where he's going to start thinking about getting out.
Yeah.
What will he do next? Will he actually become that, what was the word, altruistic sort that he was portrayed as, but was being falsely portrayed as, because that wasn't really what he was at the core. So I think it's a lot of speculation on where this is all going to go, but there's some kind of a smart brain, if not yet calculating and somewhat sociopathic at this stage, but hopefully that will be mellowed out over the next 20 to 25 years that he has time to think about this.
Could set up a ramen exchange.
A ramen exchange.
I believe ramen is a well-used currency in federal prisons.
You could tokenize ramen, I bet.
Oh, that's ramen there. You should get his application in for tech stars.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I'd do some serious legal DD on him to see if he has any past convictions.
You know what? We're laughing about it and stuff. And I think it's good sometimes to be lighthearted about stuff like this. But it's just every so often, big things like this just blow up. You know, everyone knows about Jordan Belfort, Wolf of Wall Street, and all of that kind of stuff. Who knows about Madoff? I think with FTX, it obviously wasn't the first scandal in crypto and digital assets, but it was the attitude that came with it, I think, was pretty shocking. It was almost like he felt he was like a deity, God amongst men, couldn't be touched, knew everything.
I know. 25 years. Tons of people lost millions of dollars. There's a, my wife and I were up in Lenox, Massachusetts a few years ago, actually probably just 2 years ago. So in Lenox, Massachusetts, lots of wealthy people there, lots of nice restaurants. And apparently the owner of a number of the restaurants had all of his wealth or the majority of his wealth with FTX. And he lost everything when FTX went under, including those restaurants. And I don't know what happened to them, but my wife and I had a very good time at one of them. And, you know, just examples of real world cases here where people did lose out. And it's just
completely. And like even closer to home during the financial crisis and stuff, the amount of people that had money in safe bank shares in Ireland, pensions gone overnight, completely wiped out, essentially.
So keep it all under your mattress, right?
Keep it all under the mattress, that bit.
Yeah.
Or self-custody, maybe the way to go.
Exactly. Exactly. No, hearing a lot more about that these days with a lot of folks working on some really cool ways to enable custody. We'll get there. But speaking of real world assets, we've got big news coming from BlackRock in the last couple of weeks, and that they have launched a tokenized fund, and it's called BUIDL, B-U-I-D-L, which is the BlackRock USD Institutional Digital Liquidity Fund. And this is a play on words. What's in a name, right? In that BUIDL is a play on the word HODL, or H-O-D-L, which is the famous misspelling of something on a tweet a few years ago where someone said that they were going to hold, right? And that they were referring to, I'm not going to sell, I'm not going to buy, I'm going to hold. And it was just, he misspelled it or she misspelled it as H-O-D-L. And somehow the press got a hold of that and thought that it was an acronym for hold on for dear life, but it's not. So what we've seen is a number of, especially during the bear market, probably a little bit before that as well, is that people have taken that HODL and they've played that into, well, I'm going to go build my business, but I'm going to BUIDL it. And the thing with this fund is that it is on-chain. This is basically the closest thing to a money market fund.
Yeah.
And it is a money market fund that you would find in TradFi and the funds industry that, you know, I was part of for a long time, that you've been quite integrated in for a very long time as well in the past, Paul. The fund itself is transacted on chain. So you buy shares of the BUIDL fund on chain on Ethereum, but your transactions are going through a more traditional platform hosted by Securitize, led by CEO Carlos Domingo, who I've met a couple of times. They are one of the kind of OGs in this space trying to bring security tokens into the mainstream. They've been working on this for a very long time. And this finally now, for Securitize at least, is a big jump forward for them. They're regulated as a transfer agent in the US. They do all the responsible filings with the SEC that they need to be doing in order to stay above board with all this. And that they are, the way that the fund actually works is that, yes, your purchases and your redemptions need to go through Securitize. And they need to reflect everything that's on-chain. They need to reflect that off-chain so they can send the security master file to the SEC when they're filing basically the share register, who holds what. So it looks like, from an on-chain perspective, that it is an on-chain money market fund, right? It looks and smells a little bit like a yield-bearing stablecoin, but it is actually a security. And so that means that anyone who is not a regulated broker-dealer in the US, they can't sell it. So this isn't an asset that you can go to a crypto exchange, a centralized crypto exchange, and buy and sell. You can't do that because it's security. It's a big step forward, a huge step forward, in terms of trying to build this bridge between TradFi and crypto, but it is something that still is a little bit of a ways off. One interesting point that I heard on the podcast I listened to this morning was Bankless, and they had Carlos Domingo on from Securitize, who were the main service provider, the tech platform that is connecting the off-chain world to the on-chain world here. He said that there is a, because this is all on chain, you can go out onto Etherscan and check it out. Just go onto Etherscan and put in BUIDL, B-U-I-D-L, that there is an on-chain contract that allows for a swap between USDC, the stablecoin, and the BUIDL shares, the tokenized security there. So they were talking about that as being a very exciting thing. It's not It hasn't been publicized. That exists yet. And again, even if you wanted to get Biddle shares, there was a minimum investment, I think, of the advertised one is $5 million, but I think the fund documents are saying something like $100,000.
I think it was 100.
Yeah. So it's a big step in the right direction. But it's, and I think they're already at something like 245 million after a week.
Yeah.
And, but for all the, you know, crypto OGs out there, it's not anything that they can rush to in a hurry because it's not a retail product. And,
yeah.
they, you know, so unless you're kind of the treasury of a DAO where you're dealing in the millions and the tens of millions sometimes with managing your treasury, that, you know, the average crypto investor with 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 USD worth of liquidity won't be able to get into that. So,
Yeah, it feels like the technology is the important piece in this.
It is.
With it being on chain.
It's a big important part of it. One of the other podcasts that I listen to a lot and I talk about is the On the Brink podcast from Castle Island Ventures, Nick Carter and Matt Walsh. And I think it was probably about, I don't know, 20 episodes ago, they had one of the guys on from Coinbase who was talking about what they had built around the ETF infrastructure for the Bitcoin ETF. I don't know whether it was Matt Walsh, who was the host of that podcast, or the guy from Coinbase who was on who said this, but it was either way a suggestion that, listen, if we built all this for an ETF that is enabling the holding of tokenized assets, obviously Bitcoin is a token, that imagine what we would be able to do when the traditional markets start trading tokenized assets. And so you've got that side of it. You've got Securitize, which probably are the ones in the whole business that have been working on these types of things. Shout out to Fund Admin Chain and Brian McNulty, but probably business better known as FAC at this stage, who've been working on this as well. And that they've built so much around this that we'll be able to plug into this tokenized world. But the, you know, Securitize have been at it since I first got into this space. And I remember them as being one of the OGs in this.
I was at a couple of years ago, back when people were talking about it, it was about the separation. So the technology was in and of itself a good thing that could be used for things away from crypto. So if you're talking about a blockchain business, it doesn't necessarily have to be linked to crypto. And it feels like this is kind of the same thing where it's that separation and people are starting to really embrace the technology within TradFi that would have been always linked to crypto and seen as, you know, risky and not something that they want to get involved in, even though that's obviously changing as well. But it does feel like it's that technology piece. And I mean, you know, obviously probably better than me, the amount of advantages that you have building something on chain as opposed to how we used to do it. It's still done at the minute for the majority of traditional financial services.
Yeah, and it's almost equivalent back to, again, you know, hedge funds back in the early 2000s when you had traditional firms that were going all the rage about hedge funds. Like, we need to buy a hedge fund service provider if you're a fund administrator. If you're a big asset manager, you need to bring some people on who could manage a sleeve of assets that could be put into a hedge fund vehicle. And then all the changes in regulation that came around this in 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, that feels like Sesame Street, me saying that or something. But all of these, it's financial innovation. It's financial innovation. You're not going to stop it. You're not going to put it back in the box. And back in 2015, 2016, when I got into the space, there was that whole camp of blockchain, hate crypto. And for me, it all came together around 2017, 2018, where it was, you can't really have one without the other. What you can have one without the other is that the top 10 crypto assets out there are 95% of the value of crypto. And 5%, you've got so much junk in there, just useless stuff, tons of meme coins. The ability to tokenize emotion is where we're playing right now on the further end of the crypto spectrum. Do with that stuff what you want. But at the same time, it's like if you are leveraging crypto for your own financial wealth, for your own financial means, for savings, for that type of stuff, stay in the waters where you know you can swim, which is probably a bad example for liquidity because the deepest waters of liquidity are in the Bitcoin and ETH end of crypto. But anyway.
Yeah. Stay away from the crypto bros and the scantily clad people with sushi on them.
Yes. Yes. That was a surprise. That was a surprise to see. In
I thought we got past all that stuff.
I know. Tell what happened there.
So we reported in the Financial Times recently, Copper, who are custodian essentially, held an after party in the Mandrake Hotel, a 5-star hotel. I'm sure you've been, Pete.
Nope.
After the digital assets. And among other things, they had a man and woman in bodysuits with plates of sushi, essentially partially naked bodies. So, you know, it's hard not to think of the Wolf of Wall Street that we mentioned earlier on and the discussion around the table of what could they do with the dwarfs that they were getting. You know, how far could they push it? It was that whole scene of kind of testosterone build, what's the word, excessiveness and F everyone else.
Yeah.
If I can say letter on your podcast.
Yes. No, you could say the full thing if you would like, Paul. Go ahead. For unlawful carnal knowledge.
Exactly. But it's just that whole idea of the crypto bros, you know, this idea that there's a bit of a men's club in blockchain and crypto in general. And this idea that stuff is still okay just set the wrong tone.
Totally.
And I think particularly when it's an industry that struggled with reputation, with things like FTX and other issues that have come up previously. And for an industry struggling with reputation and getting over it so well, I think, in the last few years, it's just shocking to see. It really is shocking to see that someone somewhere could have approved something like this. Like, you can't blame no prior knowledge, whatever. Someone somewhere knew this was going to happen. And then the fallout from us, you know, saw on LinkedIn the other day, Zodiac Custody ceasing their partnership with Copper, which was just announced in December. I'm sure there's others out there that are at least questioning what's going on. So it has a real business impact. But I think the fallout from this, even though it may not be kind of widely reported on, it is going to be that this stuff just isn't okay and isn't going to run with an industry that's starting to gain traction and gain interest from institutional investors and become a lot more mainstream and everything else. This stuff just isn't okay anymore.
When I saw that, I was wondering if someone missed the memo, right? When you have a business the scale of Copper,
yep,
that you may hire a party planner and say, listen, we're here in London, we're going to this event, we're sponsoring some activities here at the conference, we want to have a party afterwards, can you please set this up for us? And maybe someone who has been on the fringes of crypto or not even involved in crypto said, all right, tell me about crypto. And someone told them about crypto from the year 2017. And that, yes, there is still a lot of this stuff floating around out there. But, you know, at the Token 2049 conference in London in 2022, when I was outside that conference venue, there was a Lamborghini parked outside. In 2023, that Lamborghini was gone because we're in the middle of a bear market. And so, yeah, I think someone missed the memo here that this is not what we're trying to project in crypto these days. And that, yeah, very unfortunate. There's, you know, just reading into some of this, though, that Copper was founded in 2018 in East London, has unsuccessfully sought to gain regulatory approval from the UK's FCA. And then you look at businesses like Archax and Graham Rodford, who's been on the show way back in 2018. Shout out to Graham. Always good with intros, Mr. Graham Rodford. That they did get their regulatory approval back in 2019, 2020, I think. Right? They were one of the first ones to get it in the UK as a crypto service provider and as a custodian. You know, so, and I know him. I know the folks in that business, and I kind of know how they carry themselves, and I know the heritage of their business and where they came from and their understanding of governance and those types of things, and understanding of how to project the image of your business. Again, still some lessons to be learned here. I'm hoping that it was a bad decision of a party planner missing the memo rather than the CEO of Copper signing off with a briefing on, hey, here's what we're going to do at the party. We're going to have a man and a woman dressed in their swimsuits and lying down on a bar, and people be picking their sushi off of their bodies.
Yeah.
To me, that's just gross.
Yeah.
Like,
unsanitary at best. Worried about the tummy bug the next day.
Exactly. So not for me either in image or in taste.
Yeah. I think like these things can happen and you can have anomalies, but you know, I just got to be a little bit of a concern about the culture and someone has to have seen it somewhere. And what part of that person thought, this is okay for us. As I said, this could be a complete anomaly. And obviously, we don't know the ins and outs of exactly how it went down or who approved what or what they actually proved and what they saw, etc. But, you know, companies talk about values an awful lot. And a lot of the times those values are developed in a boardroom or a little subcommittee. And it's like, these are the values that we want to have. But you go ask the employees about the values and they can't tell you.
No.
And they certainly don't relate to whatever it is that you've decided your values are. I think that idea of kind of lived values is something that is becoming more and more important, certainly from a recruitment perspective, particularly at the senior end now, where people want to believe in the business that they're going into. And they want to believe in the mission, they want to believe in the values, they want to really kind of buy in and get behind it. And I think if I think of the senior end, you know, age bracket wise, probably my age plus the generation coming behind, typically, I think are even more interested in all of that and want to buy in, because you're spending a significant portion of your life working somewhere and, you know, you want to be authentically you and whatever. And those values need to align to who you are as a person.
Yeah.
This type of stuff just
yeah. I know. When it comes to the values, and we talk to the Techstars founders a lot about this, Paul, is that one of the first questions we ask them on the onboarding questionnaire is, what are your values? What are the values for your business?
Yeah.
Some of them list out some really good ones that I can get behind. Others list ones that need some work. But at the end of the day, I don't matter all that much when it comes to interpreting their values as an investor, because I get to know them and I figure out what they're all about. It's about how they carry that forward into their business when the business goes from 4 people to 8 to 16 to 32 to 64. And that's the big thing. There have been companies that, and I forget who it was, that they asked their first customer, they said, listen, can we have a pair of your old shoes? We're going to bronze them and put them up in our meeting room to remind people that we need to walk a mile in the customer's shoes.
Yeah.
And they did that with something like their first 100 customers. And still to this day in their boardroom are the bronze shoes of 200 shoes, right?
Yeah.
They take the two of them. And you have to constantly be reminding the team of these things. And every time that someone gets hired, they kind of have to go through this indoctrination into, or they have to go through this immersion into your values. They have to.
Yeah. Yeah. Indoctrination may be too strong a word. But,
too strong a word. Yes.
But yeah, absolutely. And if they don't get it, and like it needs to be authentic. So like you talked about Reds and his speech, I think it was the second parole hearing you seen, and it was authentic. It was like, you know, you tell me, have I done enough? Have I changed? Whatever. He was being his authentic self, probably a little bit pissed off at the situation that has come up again. But in the first parole hearing you see, he was telling them what he thought they wanted to hear. And it just comes off as fake. And it's the same with a company. If your values are fake and they're not lived values, then they're just words on a wall. That's it.
Totally. Totally. I know. So speaking of finding values, I think there's been a way to see some value in what's been going on in the fintech funding situation. And I know that you had an interesting look inside that a few weeks ago, and you found some insights that you wanted to share, didn't you?
Yeah. So it was an S&P report, and the headline was, venture capital flows into fintechs dropped 42% year over year to $35 billion in 2023. And this is according to the S&P Global Market Intelligence data. As you read through, you know, at the headline, it sounds pretty rubbish, and it probably echoes an awful lot of what people would see, and totally what's happened over the past while, that funding has been an awful lot tighter and it's been an awful lot more difficult to get funding and everything else. But I think as you read through, there's some signs for optimism. It's not to suggest that the headline is clickbait in any way, or maybe I see the positives in anything.
Well, it's the S&P Global Market Intelligence. I don't think they're driven too much by clickbait opportunities, right?
You'd be surprised. S&P don't.
Yeah, well, you never know. Like you said, someone may have missed a memo, but...
Someone may have missed. Yeah. As you read through anyway, what it's talking about, the major drop-off that there was in terms of fintech funding over the past years, talk about funding deals, volumes dropping 35%, $35.5 billion in 2023, which was a drop of 42% in terms of their analysis. But such a massive drop seems to have, they say anyway, bottomed out.
One of the big takeaways for me from this was just in the headline, as you said, it was the last few words of the headline, which were, but downturn may be nearing end. Okay, that yes, fintech funding falls 42% to $35 billion in 2023, but the downturn may be nearing an end. And I was like, what's the root of that? Okay, and that there was a big bump in valuation from Stripes Rays. If you take that out of it, then, okay, things don't look as rosy. There was some sentiment that people mentioned that I thought was interesting. But the thing that I was thinking about is, what is the correlation of all of this to crypto prices? Because some people will look at crypto and say, well, crypto is just fintech. And I kind of align with that a bit myself, in that financial technology, crypto's initial use case was for financial technology. Okay, so there's this melding of crypto, and that fintech funding programs, fintech VCs, the less conservative ones, I'll just call them that, they have a sleeve of their investment theme, their investment process, their practice areas. They're dedicated to crypto and DeFi, okay? So there is this correlation there. And I was thinking about, we've got a crypto bull run now back underway, which is great. It feels different this time. I think it will feel different every time, as it has in the last, you know, 7-8 years I've been in this space. But who's kind of driving the bus here if you're looking at this correlation between crypto and fintech? And what would happen with crypto and with fintech back in 2021 is that we had a very low interest rate environment. We had money printing going on because of COVID. We had valuations at an all-time high in the startup space, and fintech enjoyed that. Crypto enjoyed that for crypto startups getting funded. And then the bubble grew too big and the bubble popped and everything came crashing down. Crypto crashed, VC investing across the board disappeared, and that it wasn't just crypto and fintech, it was everything. And then we went through a couple of years and things started to upswing again. Did the interest rate increases have the effect on the economy that the Fed and other central banks around the world wanted it to have? I don't know. This macroeconomic formula still wrecks my head, but if there is a correlation here between the downturn ending in fintech and a crypto bull market underway, does this crypto bull market, the optimism of that and the hype of that sometimes seep into more traditional financing mindsets? Are we there yet? Is it at that point where the crypto bull run is then signaling to other segments of financing activity that it's okay to get back in the water? Or is this an anomaly?
Is that a bit of a stretch?
Is this an anomaly? Is this just, hey, we had the BTC ETF, we had the boomers coming in, we have the halving coming up, and Colin Platt, shout out to Colin, he was on the show years ago as well. He posted something on Twitter a few weeks ago that was like, silly boomers, didn't you know the halving's already priced in? If you look at CNBC, like the apps on my phone that I use for news to keep track, I've got CNBC, I've got BBC, I've got the Journal, which is an Irish one, and I've got the Business Post that I look at for mainstream news. And then I've got CoinDesk and a few other views into crypto news that I look at for crypto news and things going on there. And I see the sentiment on CNBC, which is largely TradFi, improving. Is there more of a link here between crypto and traditional finance in terms of sentiment and driving and prices and all that than we thought?
Not to be skeptical, I think it's a bit of a reach at this stage. I don't think crypto has that level of influence.
I think you're right. But I think you're right. It's that I'm just sensing something here that is changing a bit, that just be two parallel strands of things that are happening that aren't related to each other. No matter how much you look at the 500 million plus crypto wallet addresses, it's still something like less than 20 million users of crypto in their day-to-day lives. That's tiny compared to the global population of 8 billion people. So I just can't see how the sentiment is crossing over to signal that, okay, we're nearing the end of a downturn, and then we see a crypto bull run happening at the same time. Isn't connected. I'm saying logically, it can't be. It's impossible just because of the pure numbers of mathematics and the probabilities and people and what they're using and what they're doing in their day-to-day lives. But at least from a news flow perspective, because of my view of the world, it just seems connected.
Well, anything is possible. No great coaching business. Possible.ie. But anything is possible. I think if you think about it and you think about the macro environment, I think that certainly plays into it. And there seems to be an end coming to high interest rates, or this level of high interest rates that we'll necessarily go back to previously. So, you know, interest rates go up. It's less risky, obviously, to have your money in rates or treasuries. So why would you need to invest your money in stuff that's a little bit more risky, like it had been over the past while? And then there's the lack of opportunity to actually get your money out as well, with real lack of action still in the IPO market. There's not a huge amount of liquidity events. And you got to think, when some of that does start, capital gets returned to investors, hopefully positively, then the sentiment starts to improve a little bit again. But, I, you know, like we saw, certainly the first half of 2023 was really quiet from a fintech recruitment perspective, which I think is always indicative. The lack of funding and the lack of there to hire, essentially. That definitely changed in the second last year. And it's continued. I think that trend for us anyway has continued. I suppose I get more and more focused every year into fintech. And I include Web3, DeFi, blockchain, crypto in fintech at the minute. But this is the busiest quarter I've had for sure, or the end of the busiest quarter I've had for sure in that sort of space, which would suggest to me that things are improving.
Okay.
Certainly confidence is sent.
Okay. I think this might be a typical case of me reading too much into a headline and projecting what I would like to see in the world into a headline. Yes, which is...
clickbait.
Exactly. Exactly. So, Jesus, you were right. It's clickbait. S&P does clickbait. Yeah. Good for
Everyone's
them.
Everyone's in on it.
Good for them. They didn't miss the memo. So, well, listen, let's wrap it there. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. We covered a bit of the U.S. today. That was a show, wasn't it? Mr. Smith Goes to Washington?
No idea. It could have been the U.S. show.
I don't know. I'll figure it out. But thank you, Paul. Really awesome to talk through these things with you. Thank you for helping me to do this today. I really appreciate it.
Happy to help.
All right. Ciao. That does it for this week, folks. You can learn more about the stories we covered in the show notes on our website, moneyneversleeps.ie. Thanks to Paul Smith for all the insights he shared in co-hosting this episode with me. If you like what you heard, please leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, as it helps others to find the show. Also, thanks to Conan Brophy from Create Sound for mixing and editing this episode. Conan is an excellent media man to get in touch with when you're thinking about launching your own podcast. As for me, I'm an early stage startup investor focused on where fintech meets crypto and crypto meets Web3, and I lead the TechStars Web3 Accelerator. There are plenty of links in the show notes on moneyneversleeps.ie on how to get in touch, so don't hesitate to reach out. Finally, till next time, thanks for listening. See ya! Money never sleeps, pal.